and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Chicago's budget for police misconduct settlements is almost exhausted just 4 months into the year. First Amendment concerns on college campuses as the Trump administration revokes some international student visas.
The lakefront, by right, belongs to the people.
And Jeffrey Baer gives us a fresh take on the lakefront's history and culture in a new special. And now to some of today's top stories. Chicago Public School teachers have ratified their newest contract with the district. It is the first time in 15 years the two sides have agreed to a deal without a strike vote from the teachers' union.
And when I say Democratic, we voted on everything. Yes. People got an opportunity to touch it, feel it, see it. And last Thursday and Friday, they voted in an overwhelming, historic levels to ratify this TA to a contract.
The Chicago Teachers Union says 85% of its 30,000 members voted last week. Of them, 97% approved the contract proposal. CPS says the contract will cost $1.5 billion over the life of the contract, raising teacher salaries a minimum of 4% annually, while also enforcing class size limits and adding teacher prep time. District board members are set to vote on the contract later this month. President Stacey Davis Gates will join us on Wednesday evening for more on that contract. Governor J.B. Pritzker says he and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro have been in contact after news broke fires to Shapiro's home yesterday morning. At a news conference today, Pritzker said he and his security team are following the updates.
The world has devolved, where attacks on elected officials are happening more frequently. They're more dangerous and deadly. This happened on Passover, on the first night of Passover, which I don't know if it was related to the attack, but they're investigating even now. But I can say that anti-Semitism has been on the rise across the United States for several years now.
Local authorities confirmed the man suspected of starting the fire was captured the same day and will face charges of attempted murder, terrorism, aggravated arson. Family and friends are raising money to support the family of Chicago police officer Melissa Torres. Police say Torres died last week from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. A GoFundMe page shows Torres leaves behind her husband Nico and 10-year-old son Mason. It has already surpassed its $30,000 goal. And the U.S. Postal Service is offering up to $150,000 as a reward for helping identify three alleged thieves. The agency shared a new poster today with images of the three people suspected of robbing a letter carrier around 748 South Francisco Avenue back in January of 2023. As part of Project Safe Delivery, USPS and the Postal Inspector began increasing reward amounts to combat the surge in mail theft and violent crimes against letter carriers. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Postal Service hotline. Up next, the city blows through a major budget item in just months.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Chicago's budget for police misconduct settlements is almost tapped out just 4 months into the year. That's according to city records analyzed by our own Heather Sharone, who joins us now with more. Heather, how did the city end up spending so much money to resolve lawsuits alleging police misconduct?
Well, the costliest lawsuits fall into pretty much two buckets. One, lawsuits filed by people who spent years in prison convicted of murders that they did not commit. The other bucket, of course, is the police pursuits that ended in grave injury or death, even though those policies violated CPD policy. On Wednesday, the city council is set to approve a settlement of $32 million $1 million for a St. Louis man who was gravely injured as a result of a police pursuit sparked by a tinted license plate cover. He lost both his legs, and his wife was there when the injury happened.
This tally, now it only includes settlements city officials approved, not jury verdicts. Why not?
Well, twice in the last 6 months, jury verdicts have set new records for those who spent time behind bars convicted of crimes they did not commit. First, in September, $50 million went to a man who spent 10 years behind bars. But just last month, $60 million went to two men each who spent a combined 32 years in prison. Now, the city is appealing all of those verdicts, so they are not yet final, and taxpayers haven't yet had to pay a dime. I should mention a third verdict, $80 million to the family of a 10-year-old girl who was killed again during a police pursuit.
Okay. And you spoke with Alderman Gilbert Villegas. He plans to take action at Wednesday's city council meeting to demand answers from city officials. What is his plan?
Well, he's going to invoke a rarely used rule to force representatives of Mayor Brandon Johnson to come to a finance committee meeting and answer questions about their strategy for handling these lawsuits. He has a lot of particular questions about more than 200 lawsuits that name one of three disgraced Chicago police officers who have uncontested records of misconduct. That's John Burge, Detective Reynaldo Guevara, and former Sergeant Ronald Watts. None are active on the force now, but their legacy is still going to be very costly for taxpayers.
Still costing the city for sure. Heather Sharoon, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. More than 300 international students have had their visas revoked by the Trump administration in recent days. That group includes students attending Northwestern, the University of Chicago, and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, which has one of the highest international student enrollments in the country. The White House pushing for more cancellations raises concerns over what it all means for students and higher education. Joining us now with more is Ed Yonka, the communications director for the ACLU. Ed, welcome back.
So it's good to be back.
The Trump administration is citing national security when revoking student visas. What's your reaction to that argument?
It's not clear what the national security cause actually is, what the threat actually is. These are people who are here, who are attending school, who are adding to both the and enriching both the campuses on which they study, but also the body of knowledge that we have in the U.S. And suddenly, you know, they get an email in the middle of the night suggesting that they're kicked out and need to be gone in a short period of time. I think it's really troubling, and there ought to be, you know, much more process and much more transparency about what's actually going on here.
Is the administration citing any other reasons beyond those campus protests from the last year over the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza?
Well, that's the part I think that's really interesting about this, Brandis. You know, we've seen, you know, Mahmoud Khalil and other students who've been specifically detained and deported over their speech. And what we've heard about these revocations, this sort of rash of revocations that we've seen recently is that these are not necessarily speech related, but other sort of vague kinds of things. It does raise, I think, the concern about whether or not there's an underlying kind of speech or racial motivation to any of this, or exactly what is driving this on the part of the administration. So yes, I'd say, you know, there's not a lot of other reasons being given, but I think speech and freedom of expression, freedom of association is something that all of us ought to be concerned about with this.
So U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio addressed his reasoning in a cabinet meeting last week. Here's that.
If you come to this country as a student, we expect you to go to class and study and get a degree. If you come here to like vandalize a library, take over a campus and do all kinds of crazy things, you know, we're going to get rid of these people. And we're going to continue to do it. So when we identify lunatics like these, we take away their student visa. No one's entitled to a student visa.
Ed, your thoughts?
First of all, the idea that the Secretary of State of the United States is labeling students as lunatics without having any information about any of them. Secondly, if they vandalize something, that's a crime and they ought to be charged with a crime. But people are not being charged with crime. Instead, they're being punished for their speech. You know, recently ICE actually said that they weren't going to let bad thoughts into the United States. That was something that they actually put on their social media accounts and then pulled them back. The reality is that, you know, this is an administration that doesn't like people who take a different view than they do. They don't like people. They don't like something like a university that could be a center for study that would disprove the kind of wild conspiracy theories that they like to spin around. And so, you know, universities and these students are an easy place for them to punish, but also to eliminate any critics of this administration.
Do international students, do they have the, you know, the same rights of protest and free speech as American students? I mean, because like you mentioned, you know, if you vandalize a library, if you're an American student, then you're charged with a crime. You're not sent somewhere.
Although the president suggested today he may want to send people to El Salvador who are U.S. citizens. But let's talk for a minute about those rights, because I think it's a really important point. The Constitution of the United States says that we have the right to free speech, free expression in this country. We have the right to petition and air our grievances against the government. It never once reserves that right to citizens. Anyone who's present, the founders knew when to use the word citizen and when not to, and they only used it when it was called for. They do not, it is not there in terms of the First Amendment. All of us have the right to free speech, whether we're a citizen or not.
Now, all of this said, though, universities are still being asked to sort of reckon with the anti-Semitic attacks that they might be experiencing on campus. Just today, the Daily Northwestern reporting graffiti and flyers being found on campus. How should schools balance the rights of Jewish students, obviously, and other marginalized groups to be safe with the rights of other students to protest and have free speech?
I'm glad you said balance it, because unfortunately, we seem to have gotten out of balance. Where there are students who aren't safe because of anti-Semitic attacks, where there is anti-Semitism being demonstrated in that way, you know, that's a place where universities have to act, because one of their obligations is to ensure that everyone feels safe on campus, to make sure that everybody has an experience to be able to learn and grow and mature. But at the same time, a part of that learning, growing, maturing is protesting. And just because somebody is protesting about something that makes you uncomfortable isn't a reason to stop that person from protesting. But if those attacks become directed at people, are personal, involve criminal acts, then that is a place where certainly universities need to step in and act.
Universities themselves, they are being very quiet about this issue.
Too
many
quiet.
Of them not even confirming the number of students
yes.
on their campuses or yeah. among their enrollment who are being impacted. What does all of that tell you?
It tells me that the bullying tactics of the administration aimed at universities and other institutions is working. Because this is a thing, this is a place where we ought to have full transparency. We ought to know the number of people who've been revoked. We ought to know why they've been revoked. Well, not necessarily information about individuals, but information about the circumstances under which individuals are having their visas revoked. Because we ought to have a public discussion about it. One of the things when we talk about free speech that we rarely talk about is, unless you and I know what our government is doing, there's no way for us to debate whether those policies are correct. I think the universities are doing disservice to their students by being so quiet, but they're doing it because they're being threatened and bullied and coerced, you know, by the administration. Because the first university that steps out of line on this is going to be threatened with a cutoff of funding, the way that we've seen other universities, you know, deal with those threats.
This came up earlier in our conversation as well, Ed. The federal government reportedly checking social media accounts of immigrants. What do you make of that?
I think, again, this is one of those things that's just a horrible idea. I mean, the notion that somehow in order to become a citizen, to get a visa, to come here, we're going to have the government rifle through your social media, Look who you're associating with. Look at what kind of accounts you look at, who you follow and who you like. That doesn't really tell us anything about anyone. You know, it just so happens on social media, I follow Donald Trump. I assure you, I am no fan of Donald Trump's. But somehow they're going to read something into that social media. The reality is that this allows for people to make arbitrary and capricious decisions about people based on what they're doing on social media. That's not how we should handle who we allow into the country and who we don't.
Okay. Obviously, a lot to keep an eye on here. Ed, I'm sure we'll have you join us again sometime soon. Ed Yonka, ACLU of Illinois.
Prince.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, a new exploration of Chicago's crown jewel. From its many vibrant beaches to the tours and cruises it inspires, Chicago's beloved lakefront is a defining part of the city's culture and identity. Jeffrey Bayer's new special, Touring Chicago's Lakefront, explores how the iconic shoreline became what it is today. Take a look.
There's Lollapalooza, Blues Fest, Taste of Chicago, and the thunderous sound of NASCAR.
Joining us now is the man who gets all the good gigs as the program's host, our very own Jeffrey Bayer. Welcome back, Jeffrey. Good
Thank
to have you.
Thank you.
Here.
I love being here.
So you have been doing these programs for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
And you've done quite a few lakefront specials, though, in the past. What's unique about this one?
Well, we have to make these shows again because they become outdated. We can't rerun them anymore. So our producer, Mike West, and I really thought this time around, let's do things we've never done before. So, I dive a shipwreck. I'm not a scuba diver, but there's a shipwreck literally a few hundred yards offshore at 47th Street about 8 feet of water. So you just put on, a snorkel mask and you can dive it. We go to a rodeo at South Shore Cultural Center. It was my first rodeo.
Literally.
we just did all kinds of things. Fishing. I went fishing for the first time ever in my life. Fishing's a big thing in Lake Michigan. So we just decided to do things we'd never done before.
Yep, we're going to come back to some of those firsts. What is it that you think makes Chicago's lakefront so special, so unique?
Well, I think it truly is unique in the world in the sense that it's been preserved for the people. Our whole lakefront is a park. And there was a big battle to preserve the lakefront as a park back in the 19th century. And in literally every other waterfront city, if you think of, the coastal cities, New York, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, other Great Lake cities, Milwaukee, Cleveland, the lakefront is pretty much given over to industry. And our lakefront could have become industrialized, as you see in Northwest Indiana. But there were some lawsuits in the early days. We talk about this in the program. And really, we're the only city that I know of in the country, maybe in the world, where our whole waterfront is public land and it's parks.
So as we mentioned, you do a lot of firsts in this program,
yeah.
Like fishing. Here's a look at some of those.
Oh, good.
Uh-huh. Two.
Whoa. What do I do?
All right, tip up, Jeff. Tip
up here.
Put him right here.
Stop right here.
The bottom here.
No.
Keep that rod right here.
Put this right here.
Right here.
There you go.
Real.
Real.
Whoa,
nice
I can
shot.
Feel that.
Yeah, you can.
Jeez. I think I got a big one.
So many instructions to follow when
it
you're fishing.
It was crazy. It was that fish. This is not a fish story. That fish was like,
I once
it was
caught
a lake
a fish
trout.
This big.
Yeah, it was a lake trout. We caught like 12 fish. Have you ever been fishing?
No. Certainly not on Lake Michigan.
No, I had never been fishing. I said to the fishing boat captain, you know, I got all these cameras here, you know, and a producer and everything. Are we going to catch any fish? And he said, never come back without a fish. And we came back with like 12 fish. It was crazy.
So obviously you took them home and like you scaled them and you cooked them and all that stuff,
well,
right?
Well, we divvied them up. And yeah, I mean, we looked it up online, and the health authorities do say that you should limit the amount of fish that you eat from Lake Michigan because there are trace contaminants in the water. I think certain fish, it should be one a month, certain fish, it should be one a week. And, you know, so we tried to follow those instructions.
Of course, I was more curious about your skills with scaling.
Oh, no.
Fish.
The first mate, one of the people giving me the advice on the boat, did the whole thing, cleaned the fish while we were on our way back, which was another whole thing to witness.
What was that like, though? You know, 30 years of doing these and a whole bunch of other lakefront specials, and this is finally your first time getting to do something like that on Lake Michigan.
I had a little bit of remorse, actually, when I caught the fish. You know, I eat fish, so I don't have any right to, you know, complain. But I, you know, the thing was fighting for its life, and I'm going to kill it, you know? So... and the first mate in the show, he says, you know, a lot of people feel that way, but he talks about how it's very sustainable to eat fish that you catch yourself versus fish that are store-bought that, you know, were caught with, like, less sustainable practices. So there's a good argument for it.
Right, yeah. Some people might have feelings about that, too, about the different ways that fish are raised. And
exactly.
Yes. What are some of the other things that you did in this that you've never done before? You mentioned a few of those.
I visited Northerly Island. You know, people will remember that as Miggs Field and, Mayor Daley.
The story there.
Yes, famously. We talk about it in the show. Famously dug up the runway there.
But in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, right. Well, here we... This is diving the shipwreck. So this shipwreck was from 1914. It was called the Silver Spray. All that's left of it is the boiler and the propeller. There it is.
There it is.
And look, I'm not wearing scuba gear. I'm, you know. And here I am at my first rodeo.
Literally.
As I mentioned earlier. So this rodeo is amazing. This is an African-American guy. There he is. Murdoch, the man with no first name.
Just Murdoch.
Murdoch.
Okay, man.
And he went away to the service, and he'd always loved horseback riding, and he couldn't do it. There were no horseback riding opportunities anymore in the city when he came back from the service. And he wants to share this with largely young African-American kids. And you should see, you will if you watch the show. These kids go tearing around the arena at breakneck speeds with these horses, and it was really something amazing to see.
That's impressive. Looking forward to that. So you interact with various experts, community members. Why was it important to bring those voices in?
Oh, I think, you know, when I first started doing these shows 30 years ago, I was like a tour guide. And it was just me who talked, you know. And in recent years, we've brought all kinds of other voices into the show. And I just think it makes the show so much richer. And I love these people. We met a guy down at Calumet Fisheries, which is this holdover from the days of commercial fishing on Lake Michigan. It's down under the skyway on the Calumet River. And he showed me, you know, their smokehouse, and he gave me a taste of their smoked fish there. This has been there for generations. And this is a young guy, and he just knows the whole history of the fishery, and he's so proud of it. You feel this sort of pride in these people when you interview them, and it's wonderful to have them in the show.
Definitely worth the trip to Calumet Fisheries if you haven't been,
also
for those folks. There's also some debate, though, a lot of debate about how the lakefront should be used, if it's being overrun. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about that?
Yeah, I mean, if we talk about Grant Park in particular, which we saw in the very first clip with, Lollapalooza and Taste of Chicago and now NASCAR. And, you know, a lot of people feel that that's really running afoul of Daniel Burnham's and our city's vision of the lakefront is forever open, clear, and free. You know, talk about building a new football stadium on the lakefront. It's an ongoing debate. Daniel Burnham himself, who created the plan of the lakefront in his plan of Chicago, 1909. The Field Museum is sitting where Buckingham Fountain is today. And so he was not as strict in his view of no buildings on the lakefront as other lakefront advocates like Montgomery Ward have been over the years. So there's division of opinion on that.
And before we run out of time, you know, the lakefront's also had some turbulent history.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, and that's another one of the voices we have in the show. Of course, the 1919 race riots started at a beach on the lakefront when a rock was thrown by a white racist who killed an African-American child. and it sparked the race riots. We don't shy away from talking about those things in the program either.
Always important parts of history. 15 seconds, what do you want folks to take away from this special?
Well, the lake is our one natural feature. We don't have a mountain range. We're built on a swamp, you know. And so I would hope that people would see the lake as the precious and fragile treasure that it is and be inspired to use it, but also protect it.
All right. Jeffrey Bayer, congrats on the new special.
Thank you
so much. And you can be sure to check out our website for more information on the lakefront, including a guided bike tour, invasive species in the area, and an introduction to people who swim in Lake Michigan all year round. Mm. That and much more at WTTW.com/lakefront. And while you're there, you can watch the full program or you can catch it tonight right here at 7 o'clock on WTTW. And that's our show for this Monday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan at WTTW.com/newsletter, and join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. The City Council advances a plan to transform the financial district into a residential neighborhood. That and more in Spotlight Politics. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.